It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, with over 200 places to buy alcohol near campus in a binge-drinking state, what's it like to be someone who doesn't drink? A recent UW-Madison grad tells us his story.
First, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDIC, released a report yesterday as part of an ongoing review of over 200 business tax credits. And the findings suggest that in many cases, companies were given excessive credits, which could add up to millions of dollars when all the cases are reviewed.
Matt DeFore joins us now. He's state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me again.
Well, tell us about these tax credits that WEDIC issues. It's part of their effort to boost business in the state, obviously, but they've gotten a lot of scrutiny over the last couple months and years. So what's at issue in this, in what we're hearing from yesterday?
Sure. Well, the what they're doing at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is reviewing more than 200 tax credit awards going back all the way to 2006, so even before WEDC was created. And they found about a month ago, they reported to the WEDC board that there was a discrepancy in how these tax credits were awarded and verified for companies. Basically, the amount that they the companies can get in these tax credits has to do with how many jobs they create, but they were counting certain jobs perhaps too much for what they actually should have been. In many cases, it's somebody was hired maybe mid-year, and they were getting full credit for having that person on for the entire year. So that's apparently adding up to potentially millions of dollars in over credits that they were awarding.
And how much have they reviewed this so far? This is over 200 businesses, as I understand it, and they have not reviewed all the cases closely yet.
Right. It seems like what they're doing is they're trying to keep the public and the WEDC board aware of this as they're learning things. And so just last month, they reported to the board, but they did not yet know the scope of the issue. They couldn't really tell us, well, how many tax credits are we talking about? How much money are we talking about? And the report yesterday gave us sort of our first glimpse at the scope of it. They're looking specifically at 222 awards. And what they found in the first 18 so far that have gone through two steps of the review process is that there were more than $400,000 in over credits. And so that's considering that the pool here was about $4.5 million that's already been released to these companies. You know, it's about almost 10% of the amount. And so, you know, if that holds up, if that's a representative sample, and there's no indication whether it is or isn't, it may very well be. But that's about $25,000 per award. I mean, it could be in the $5 to $6 million range, but they're really not speculating at this point as to how much it could end up being.
Is there an understanding of why these discrepancies happened? Was it that they didn't define the terms up front to say, here's what counts as a job created for a full year? Or is this something, a mistake maybe that happened later down the road?
They haven't provided a lot of information on the origin of this yet. And, I think what we're going to want to find out as this goes along is, when did it start? Did it start under Commerce? Did it start under WEDC? And, what can they tell us about why this happened and the way it did? You know, was it from the beginning of when these tax credits were created? What we do know is that they are, looking at it very closely to find out how much they over-awarded credits. And they're going to be talking with companies about potentially trying to maybe get some of the money back. But they're not looking at awards that have already been closed out. So they said that there's a different process for that. But these 222 awards do not include tax credits that were awarded perhaps with incorrect amounts and then have since been closed. They're looking primarily at awards that are still open. Maybe they're still part of the jobs haven't been created yet, and they're still waiting to give out some of the tax credits. So maybe they can recoup some of this money in future installments of the tax credits. So I think that's the main thing they're focused on right now.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about the latest news from WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Discrepancies the agency is investigating in the amount of tax credits issued to companies in the hopes of boosting jobs, and not a matchup between the number of jobs actually created and the awards given. Matt, a lot of times when a story about WEDIC starts, the phrase troubled agency is used. This comes in a backdrop of some years of criticism of what's been going on at WEDIC. Can you put this in the context of wider concerns?
Yeah, you know, I think the big issue here is that they are really trying to turn, you know, there's been a lot of changes at WEDC. This whole thing came up because the internal processes at WEDC of reviewing their programs turned up this issue. So this isn't something that the news media, you know, dug out of them. They came forward with this as soon as they found out about it, you know, as evidenced by the fact that they didn't have full information when they came forward with it. I mean, they really are reporting it out as they're finding things out. And in the past, you know, the agency has had issues certainly with tax credits and giving out loans. I think the loans issue has been one of the more prominent ones. But this, you know, Mark Hogan, the current CEO, he's the third CEO of the agency. I think he's really trying to do a lot to restore the public's trust in the agency. And so as they're addressing this issue, you know, they're doing it, trying to give as much information to the public as they can as it comes out.
That's an interesting point, Matt, because a lot of the criticism in the past has been over a lack of transparency in how things like loans and I think in some cases tax credits have been given, and apparently a lack of due diligence before these loans and tax credits are given. Is this being seen as a sign of a new transparency and a new effort to provide better accounting and documentation?
Well, certainly. I mean, that's. I think the agency they've received an audit in the past last year. They had an outside group come in and look at all the agency's practices, and so they are, you know, again, I think trying to really change the culture at the agency, make sure that it is performing as well as it can. You know, they've obviously decided they don't want to go the route of completely overhauling it. At least the governor and the legislature haven't gone that route. Even though, you know, Democrats are certainly calling for changes. But at this point, I think everyone's just trying to see what they can do to work within the current agency. It got off to a rough start back in 2011, and there were a lot of problems. But, you know, as people I've talked to who were there at the time, they've, you know, really made it really does sound like it was an issue with the agency being started too quickly and being really under a lot of political pressure to create 250,000 jobs. I think that contributed to a lot of the issues, and those issues are sort of dissipating.
Right. Democrats had been very critical, but some Republicans had called for changes in the law, for kind of cracking down and providing more oversight over WEDC. I know the legislature isn't in session right now, but do you think that these internal changes, things like this self-investigation of tax credits, will satisfy at least some key critics to where we won't see a new round of legislation in the next session?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, the session is over now. It's another 6 or 7 months. By that time, the agency on this particular issue is looking to have a full accounting of this, maybe by August. At least that's according to Mark Hogan. You know, by the time it's fully accounted for, and they maybe are able to recoup most of these tax credits, you know, lawmakers may have other issues that they're looking at. But you know, again, a lot of the stuff we keep uncovering with WEDC is from, you know, from the past. So whether the agency gets another drubbing from the legislature may turn on whether there's any current issues as opposed to issues from the past that come up.
And you mentioned the timeline here, looking by the end of the summer to finish this review of over 200 separate businesses with tax credits. Anything else in the hopper that's ongoing as the state looks at WEDC and as WEDC looks at itself?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think we'll be paying attention to how they're implementing these recommendations from this national group, and not all of them were implemented. There's still, I think that report raised some questions about whether it's effective for the agency to be hiring all kinds of outside attorneys to take care of its legal issues that's still ongoing, you know, with all these loans it's trying to collect. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they really do apply all those recommendations, or if the legislature just kind of tries to let it all go and sweep it under the rug. We'll see.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob, very much.
That's Matt DeFore, state government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about the tax discrepancies found by WEDC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, in a number of its tax credits. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we're getting ready for Memorial Day and the start of grilling season this Food Friday with the author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling.
First, UW-Madison is a regular on top 10 lists of the biggest party schools in the country. And 24/7 Wall Street recently found that 12 of the top 20 drunkest cities in the country are in Wisconsin. Madison is number 4 on that list. With all that in mind, what's it like to be a non-drinker at UW-Madison and in Wisconsin.
Well, our next guest found out over the past several years and recently wrote a piece about it in the Capital Times and the Daily Cardinal, the student paper at UW-Madison. Jonah Bilekis joins us now. He recently graduated from the UW with majors in psychology and journalism. Jonah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jonah, in broad strokes here, what was it like for you not being a drinker in college at UW-Madison?
Yeah, I think when you look at the context of, you know, being the drunkest, one of the, you know, top five drunkest cities in America, according to that study you mentioned, and list of party schools, I think the prevailing, or at least the most general word that kind of encompasses everything, I would say, is isolating. I think it's an interesting experience when you are literally in a different state of mind in a room where you're kind of don't really have enough room to move, and there's, you know, 100 people in this one restaurant or something like that, and a lot of the people are quite literally in a different state of mind. So it's been isolating, I would say. Alcohol and drinking and the culture itself is just drinking is the norm, and so it's really kind of covers a lot of different activities. It's involved in things that aren't necessarily like that in other places, from what I've been told.
Why did you decide not to drink? I know it's a personal choice for you. Why not?
Yeah, so I think personally, I've heard a lot of people give me a lot of different reasons. And from my story, I mean, it has a lot to do with I just personally don't think that I would be able to handle it. I feel like genetically, my family history, you know, my great-grandfather, of his 13 grandchildren, 9 of them became alcoholics. And so genetically, it just feels like it has something in me that I don't think that I would be able to handle it. So I never have, and it's just something I've chose to kind of stay away from. But I'm just a very personal, just like, you know, I think it's for my future well-being and the future well-being of people around me, I've just decided to stay away from it.
And so here you are at one of the top party schools in the country. Did you know that UW-Madison had that reputation when you came, and did you weigh that at all with your own choice not to drink?
Yeah, I mean, it was a factor, but I chose, so I'm from originally right outside of Chicago, so I was looking at Big Ten schools, and Madison is a great city to live in and has a lot of cool things that you can do, and the university is outstanding, and I, you know, on the other side of things, it was a good experience, but it was a part of it, but I was looking at bigger schools just from, you know, my interest in sports and interest in, you know, the academics was certainly pretty strong, so it was a factor, but obviously didn't deter me. But I was aware of it too.
And how did you handle it with your friends? Because you used the word isolating, and that's 4 years where, you know, you're in a state that already has a heavy alcohol culture. Then you're at college, where not everybody, but certainly some people think about the college experience as drinking a lot and sowing wild oats. So how did you handle that with your friends? How did you walk that line?
Yeah, so it took a lot. So it was a lot of the same conversations kind of over and over. Like I said, drinking is the norm. So it took a lot of time. I had a lot of conversations and interactions to explain to people that I didn't drink just because it's kind of the assumption that you do. But I was able to find my different support systems and my group of friends who maybe they didn't drink as much, maybe they didn't drink at all either. You know, some of the university health services people I talked to, two different people, and they said, you know, 50% of the, you know, undergraduate population can be defined as high-risk drinkers. It was interesting that both of them, you know, one said, like, holy cow, this is alarming. The other was saying that, you know, well, 50% aren't on the other side, or, you know, on the other side of it, or aren't high-risk drinkers. So there are people there, but I would say, you know, it did take some work to find, and, you know, it did take some uncomfortable situations where, you know, at the beginning and when you're first coming to college, I mean, that's kind of the thing that you do, and you kind of go to these places that maybe I didn't want to be all the time, but you kind of just go there because that's what there is to do.
Did you have any regrets ultimately about coming here? You did say you found your own path, and that's something, you know, people say in bigger schools sometimes it's easier to find your core group of people who share the way you feel and think about things. But do you have any regrets about being at this place that it did sort of throw your life and your choice into stark contrast, where maybe if you'd gone to a different school with a lower rate of problem drinkers, maybe it would have been a different experience for you?
Yeah, I think I haven't really thought that I had any regrets about coming here. I wouldn't say that I did. There's, you know, there's, it's such a, you know, there's so many different factors and a lot of different you know, things to weigh in your decision, and, you know, the location and the community and the city. And there are a lot of things that I did like that, you know, that I wouldn't have had at other schools. I did enjoy being at a big school. I thought, you know, you were able to find different smaller communities within that, whether there were extra hurdles to jump through. But I guess I don't really know. I can't really say what my experience would have been like at other places. But it's something that I learned, you know, I had to kind of go through to learn to come out on the other side of it and to be more comfortable with it. Because when I first, you know, starting to like kind of confront, you know, drinking around me, I'm a lot different than I was at, like, when all that started. I used to be very angry, and it used to really, really kind of get to me, because it just felt like this was something that was wrong, and, you know, how could this be so celebrated and everything like that. And it kind of took a lot of personal growth to get to a point where I can say that, you know, I'm comfortable with people making their decisions. Obviously, when we're trying to tackle something like the culture, I don't think that's, you know, it needs to be the way that it is. But as far as like a personal decision for people that I'm close to, it took time to kind of come to peace with everyone making their own choices.
Jonah Balekas is with us right now. He's a recent graduate from UW-Madison, and he wrote a piece recently in the Capital Times and the Daily Cardinal student newspaper about what it's like not to drink at UW-Madison. And Jonah, you just said there that you're a totally different person. Not totally, but you're a different person now than when you began in the beginning. You had to deal with a lot of anger. How did you work through that anger, and what do you think you're like, you know, now? Do you think this ultimately was a good experience?
Yeah. I think there was so much personal growth to come from a point from just an emotional maturity. And, you know, I studied psychology when I was there too, and I love, you know, thinking about how people process emotions and deal with emotions and think about things. And it was, you know, like I said, I was angry. I was frustrated that people could make the decisions that I just felt to my core that I disagreed with, and that I thought this was wrong. And I thought, you know, this like kind of prevalent, you know, binge drinking. I can't. You know, it was very, you know, a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger around that. And it kind of did take a lot of, you know, sometimes the best way to kind of get through things is to kind of push through them. And I don't think, you know, suppressing things is the best way to handle these emotions. So, you know, being around and being comfortable and having my down moments, we're able to, you know, kind of process them and learn from them and kind of come to a learning where you're able to accept people's decisions and to really, you know, understand that there's more to it. And, you know, certain decisions, I might disagree with them for me, but I can understand them from another person's perspective. So I do think that, you know, it's helped me mature a lot as a person, because, you know, there's so many other factors for other people who might cause similar reactions that kind of take some growing through and some learning to do. So I do like where I am on the other side of everything. It just kind of helps in all aspects to really be more mature and to kind of approach differences in that way.
You mentioned some bad decisions, and I know that part of your piece is you want people to think about the link between sexual assault, for instance, and alcohol. Is that something that you saw on campus that you heard about?
Yeah, I mean, it is like, you know, like the numbers I used of, you know, 90% of acquaintance rape and sexual assault on college campuses involving the use of alcohol by the assailant, victim, or both. I mean, that to me from the outside is scary. And to see, you know, I think it's a dangerous path to go into to say that, you know, alcohol makes someone do this, and I don't want to in any way make that connection. But it clearly is. The numbers show, the research shows, it's a factor, and it does impair decision making. And, you know, you just saw a lot of people make bad decisions, and whether they're getting in fights or they're getting in trouble with the law or anything like that. There were different times where it seemed like, you know, the person I know, the sober person I know, would not have done this. I think, you know, if I'm a university level, you know, I've been trying to tackle the sexual assault problem. I think it's quite clear when you have that rampant drinking culture, you know, that is one method. There's not going to be one easy answer that's going to fix such a broad, you know, societal, cultural issue like sexual assault. But one way to kind of go at it is to see, you know, what is our drinking culture and how does that impact that? And I know that there has been some, at least when I was like kind of reviewing stuff from the chancellor, wrote like a blog post about, you know, campus safety, sexual assault, and high risk drinking. So there's, you know, there's different efforts out there to kind of come at this, but I'd say, yeah, it's pretty clear that the behaviors you have and the behaviors you do when alcohol is involved, it changes things.
Jonah, you end your piece by saying, I'm Jonah. Is anybody else out there? Have you heard from anybody else who said, thank God you wrote this, I felt so alone, or people who are, I don't know, mad about what you said?
Yeah, I had not expected the amount of responses I got. I tried to get back to them, but I got about 100 emails or so.
Wow.
And messages from people that I had never met from across the country, you know, alumni, parents, teachers, you know, people who work at the university, used to go here, people who are just have never even been in the state of Wisconsin. You know, there's so many. I was really blown away, and it was really, like I said, you know, for such a feeling of isolation, and it's a little bit of that, you know, that dissonance between, you know, it's an isolating feeling, but there's so many people out there who are feeling isolated. And so it was very emotional. You know, crying, reading a little bit some of the emails. It was just so many people wrote such heartfelt messages to me and told me their stories. And for me to kind of be vulnerable and to put my story out there is a mechanism for other people to feel comfortable about theirs. It means a lot to me.
Jonah, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jonah Balekas is a recent graduate from UW-Madison. He majored in journalism and psychology, and he joined us to talk about what it was like for him being sober at UW-Madison.
If you've got a story like that, been a non-drinker in a drinking culture, share it on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, it's Food Friday, the science of grilling. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a state capitol reporter brings us up to speed on all the biggest news stories from around Wisconsin this week, including the trial in a voter ID lawsuit.
First, we're gearing up for Memorial Day here on Central Time. It's the unofficial start of summer and of grilling season.
So we brought in an expert on barbecue and grilling for this Food Friday, a man who calls himself the Barbecue Whisperer. He just wrote a book called Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, and he's here to share grilling tips and techniques.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite meals to make on the grill? What's your favorite way to cook meat outside? What have you grilled already this season? What's on the grill for this weekend? And do you have questions about grilling out? Our guest in his book has already answered, I don't know, 10, 20 of mine. Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Meathead Goldwyn joins us now. He's the co-author of the new book, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. He's also the founder of AmazingRibs.com. Meathead, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm glad to be on Food Friday. Hello, Rob and Veronica.
I got to ask you, your motto is, you say, give a man a fish and he'll probably get it stuck to his grill, teach a man to grill, and he'll become a big fish among his family and friends. Why are you such a believer in the power of grilling?
Well, the grill puts a spice on the food that you can't find on your spice rack. There's a flavor that open flame produces and smoke. Liquid smoke is no substitute. So it's a unique and very seductive flavor. Perhaps it twangs our cords from our caveman days. I don't know. But don't we love to go out back and cook?
I do. Now, I understand you say outdoor cooking is actually harder than indoor cooking. Why is that?
Well, it is because indoors you've got a thermostat on your oven, and it's fairly accurate. Now, you know, the oven goes up to a certain temperature that you set, and then it drops, the flame or the coils go off, and it goes up and down. So it creates this little, what's called a sinusoidal wave. It's a on-off, on-off cycle. But at least it holds roughly around the temperature you set. When you fire up your grill, that dial thermometer on your gas grill is garbage. That's the cheapest thing on the grill. It's the last thing that the buyer acquires for the grill. It's an old technology from the 1800s. This is the digital age. Why don't they have digital thermometers up there? And the dial is in the dome, which is great if you're going to eat the dome, but the food is down on the cooking surface, 6-8 inches below. You need a thermometer with a probe, which will go on the grate next to the meat to know what temperature the meat is feeling.
Well, so that gets us into some of the tools of the trade here. And there's not really just one way to grill. There is charcoal grilling. There's gas grilling. There's different types of heat. Do you subscribe to a particular way to go?
Well, my audience, both in the book and the website, are everybody. I mean, I just talked today to somebody who is in an apartment building and can only cook on a George Foreman-type grill, an electric grill. So I try to test on everything. My deck is about ready to collapse. My wife has laid down the law. One comes in, one's got to go out. But there's just about every device out there, and when we develop recipes, we test them on them all. For things like red meat or things that I really want a good dark sear on, I usually go to charcoal because it gets really hot and makes a great flavor. But for convenience and ease, for quick and easy on a Tuesday evening after work, it's so easy to fire up the gas grill and throw a couple of chicken breasts on there. So I use them both. I have wood pellet grills. They actually burn little wood pellets. They look like rabbit food. I have a big green, you know, I got them all. You don't want to know what's out there.
I want to bring in a caller already, Meathead. David is on the line in Beaver Dam. David, hi.
Hello. Wood pellet grill is the only way to go. The last caller that mentioned he has a wood pellet grill, I don't believe he does, because if he used it, he would know it's more convenient than a gas grill. It's more accurate than a gas. It's more accurate than a charcoal.
David, thanks for bringing that. That was you, of course, Meathead, saying you had all three kinds. Now, I bet you run into this all the time. You're agnostic. You'll use any of these different kind of grills. A lot of people will not. They have their way, and they'll only do it that way. Can we all get along?
It's semi-religious, you know. and it's interesting, that caller about the pellet grills. The people who own Traegers, which are a pellet grill brand, and the people who own Big Green Eggs are really, really devoted to their machines. You don't see that level of devotion from other cookers. I don't know why. They're good cookers. They're not the best by any means. Pellet grills are really nice, but they're best as smokers. They're not good at grilling. They don't sear a steak well. I wouldn't buy one if I wanted to make great steaks. But if I want to make ribs, pulled pork, they're wonderful for that sort of thing.
Well, let's get into some of your specific advice here. Now, one thing you want people to do is to have sort of a two-zone setup in terms of the heat. And this is kind of revolutionary to a lot of us. Why
like
so?
Me.
Like Rob.
Well, most of us go out back and particularly guys, you know. It's funny. On the website, our data shows something like 80% of our audience is male. And we don't do anything to pander to that audience. So I don't know why it seems to still be a guy thing. But we guys go out there and we turn all the burners on high, or we get the charcoal roaring and we lay it out across the bottom of the grill and get it as hot as we can get it. And the key to any kind of good cooking, indoors or outdoors, is controlling temperature. As you can indoors, you have a thermostat on your oven. We don't have that outdoors yet. Now, that pellet grills that the gentleman mentioned, they do have thermostats, and that's a real nice feature. But the others don't. Now, the way to control temperature is, if you're using charcoal, is you push all the coals off to one side. Now, some people put them on two sides, but it's much better to push them all off to one side so you have a very hot side and a not hot side. On a gas grill, you'll turn one or two burners off on one side and one or two burners on the other side. So what you have now is you have three forms of heat. You have direct radiant infrared heat coming from the heat source, from the charcoal or the gas. That's really intense heat. Then you have convection heat on the other side, where warm air is circulating, but there's no direct radiant infrared heat under the food. And so it's like in an oven. It's surrounded by warm air, and you have much better control. And then you have conduction heat, where the food is lying on top of the hot metal, and that hot metal conducts heat. So you've got three different kinds of heat at work there, and you have control over it. You can move the food from side to side, or in most cases, it's best to start the food on the indirect heat side, gently warm it, and then at the end, just before you're ready to serve, you move it over direct radiant heat and sear the heck out of it and get a good deep dark crust that way.
Talking to Meathead Goldwyn, we are grilling. He's the author of the new book, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Want to get into a recipe we've shared on our Central Time Facebook page and the Central Time website. One of the sauces you have in the book, this sounds great, chocolate chili barbecue sauce. Can you tell us about the recipe and how we should use our barbecue sauce on the grill?
Well, let me talk about the book for just a second. The book is divided in half, more or less. The first half is almost like a textbook. I hope it's more interesting than most textbooks, but it describes how heat works, how smoke works, how fire occurs and how it works, how charcoal is made and so on, meat science, and gives you all the information you need. The second half is recipes, and the recipes try to cover all the barbecue canon. So in the barbecue sauce section, I try to have a recipe for all of the regional styles that go back in history. In South Carolina, there's a mustard-style barbecue sauce that's very popular that came over with the Germans. Kansas City-style sauce is the type that we're most used to. It's the sweet red sauce, kind of like ketchup on steroids. This is something that is more creative that I just kind of came up with once for the fun of it. It's like a classic red Kansas City sauce, but we use chocolate for the sweetener instead of just plain sugar, and then we give it a cut of hot chipotle, or you could use ancho. You can improvise on these, but that's a nice combination. I mean, if you go to a gourmet chocolate shop, you'll often find chocolate and chipotle or chocolate and ancho in chocolate bars. So we did a barbecue sauce with it. It's really fun. It's really nice. If you use a sauce like this, it's got so much going on, you don't even need a spice rub to go underneath it.
Wow. So chocolate chili, and would you normally put spice rub if you weren't using this one? Is that one of your techniques? I always use spice rub under the barbecue sauce?
Well, you know, in building a recipe, you often layer flavors. You start with the base food, whether it's meat or asparagus or a vegetable or a potato of some sort. You start with the natural flavor of the product. And I'm not real big on monkeying with natural flavors. I love the taste of turkey. I don't want to inject it with Dr. Pepper. I know people that do. But then you can put a little spice or seasoning on top, and that often amplifies or complements it or brings up flavors that are hidden. So a spice rub or a spice mix is always a nice thing to use. Salt is crucial. Salt turns up the volume on everything. And in meat, salt gets down into the meat, and it actually binds with the protein and helps the protein hold on to moisture. Your other seasonings like paprika and sugar and garlic and pepper, the molecules are too large. They can't get into meat. But salt is the magic rock. Salt, sodium and chloride, that's all. Very small molecule. And when they get wet, they get electrically charged and they move. So you really want to use salt. And then the last element of this orchestra of flavors that we're building might be a sauce. So that's typical, for example, of, say, ribs. Start with the pork ribs, put down a rub, put down some salt, and at the end of the cooking, that's when you add the sauce, when you're almost done, because if you put a sweet sauce on early in the cooking process, you're going to burn it.
Wow, well, that sounds delicious. So we're going to get into a little bit more when we come back, talking to Meathead Goldwyn, co-author of the new book, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, getting his advice for cooking outside this summer.
Taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question, a how-to question about cooking on the grill? Meathead probably has an answer. And what's your favorite grilling recipe? What are you cooking this weekend? And what do you cook on? Are you a partisan of charcoal or wood pellet or gas? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post and find that chocolate chili barbecue sauce recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion now on this Food Friday with Meathead Goldwyn. His new book is Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What barbecue tricks do you use when you're cooking on the grill? Do you have any specific secrets or preferences to the type of grill? And do you have a favorite recipe that every winter you just can't wait to haul out the grill and make that grilled recipe? Let us know at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we will go back to our callers. We've got Paul on the line in Delafield. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What do you want to ask about, Paul?
Well, I'm waiting for the rain to clear up so I can grill. But I'm wondering when to sear and when not to sear. I like a pre-sear. Do you ever pre-sear the meat and then cook it slower?
Meathead, to sear or not to sear? That is the question from Paul.
Yeah, and he embedded in there, he's asking a more complicated and an interesting, and it shows his level of sophistication. Searing is always good with red meats and whenever you can, because searing is the changing of the proteins, the molecules on the surface, from pale and boring to dark and rich and laden with flavor. It's a reaction called the Maillard reaction. And if there's any carbohydrates or sugar in there, you'll get caramelization also. So searing and darkening the surface of meats or even vegetables, almost always desirable. Now, the question I heard in the background in there, or buried in there, was about when to sear. And this is interesting. Now, meat, you have to understand, is 70% or so of water. So it doesn't heat up rapidly. It's kind of slow. It's insulated. So when you cook on a grill, the heat, the hot air, cooks the outside of the meat. But the hot air doesn't cook the inside of the meat. The outside of the meat cooks the inside of the meat. The outside of the meat collects heat, holds it, builds it up, and slowly conducts it. This is conduction again, pushes it down into the center of the meat. So the outside of the meat is going to be hotter than the center of the meat. And so if you cook over very hot, radiant heat, you'll get very dark, great sear exterior, but you'll also get a layer of brown right below that, and then a layer of tan right below that, and then a layer of pink right below that. And if you're cooking a steak and you like it medium rare, you might get a layer of medium rare in the center. So you have this rainbow effect. The way to defeat that is to cook it first over the indirect heat, the convection heat, on the other side where the flame isn't, and gently warm it. When you do that, it heats evenly throughout. But the problem is you don't have a dark crust. So here's the trick. You get yourself a digital thermometer. This is essential to modern cooking. First of all, food is too expensive to waste, and it's too expensive, and people are too expensive to waste. People can get sick from undercooked chicken. So you want to have $30 will buy you a good digital thermometer, and it'll give you an instant read, 5 seconds, precision. You'll heat the meat on the indirect side to about 120 degrees, and then when it gets there, you move it over the direct, hot, searing red flame part, and lift the lid. So all the energy is coming from the underside and not from above, and now you build your sear. You flip it often, so you sear, and then as you flip, the heat will radiate out into the atmosphere rather than down into the meat. And then you take it up to about 130 or 135, which is medium rare, and that's the temperature at which meat is most tender and most juicy.
All right, dissertation and
but he wanted that answer. I could tell that was what was in his question. Now, let me jump in for one more second. For a really skinny steak, say under an inch, 3/4 inch, or a flank steak or a skirt steak, you got to cook that over direct heat all the way. Otherwise, you won't get a dark sear, and it'll be overcooked in the center. But for a good, juicy 1.25-1.5 steak, start indirect, then finish direct.
Talking to Meathead Goldwyn right now, co-author of the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, also the founder of AmazingRibs.com. Thanks a lot, Paul, and good luck on that grilling. We're going to go next to Curtis in Madison. Curtis, hi.
Hi, great advice. Thank you very much. I have a question. I really like to grill chicken thighs over charcoal, and I've forgotten where I learned this trick, but I parboil them first, and I think it adds the moisture. And it helps cook it, the blood out from around the bone. I'm interested in his opinion about that strategy.
All right. Chicken thighs, should he parboil them, Meathead?
That's an effective technique. Now, when you do that, if you look at the water after you've parboiled, it's very cloudy and dark. And that's flavor that you've extracted from the meat. That's because water is a solvent. And that flavor can't get back in. You're not going to miss it terribly because you're going to have spices and maybe even a sauce on there. And I understand your concern about getting the blood away from the bone. Here's the secret. Chickens today go from hatched to the grocery store shelf from 0 to 3.5 pounds in 7 weeks. That's unbelievable. It didn't used to be that way. By the time they get ready to sell in the grocery store, at 7.5 weeks old, the bones haven't completely calcified. All the blood has been removed from the chicken in the slaughtering process, but there's still a tint of blood in the marrow of the bone, and because the blood has not, the bone has not got a strong calcium layer around it, it'll sometimes discolor the meat next to the bone. Blood is of itself not dangerous, not harmful, nothing bad tasting, and it's really not bloody down in there. What you want to do is digital thermometer. 160 to 165 degrees is your done and safe temperature. Consumer Reports a couple of years ago did a research project where they found out of 300 chicken breasts they tested, almost 90%, I think it was more than 90%, had pathogenic bacteria. You can't risk cooking chicken too under. And simmering in water doesn't always add water, because the chicken is full of water. You're not going to get any more water in there. It's saturated. There's no air pockets in there. There's no place for the water to go. So you're not really making it juicier, and you are extracting flavor. I'd recommend, and this is the way I do it, I love chicken thighs. I prefer dark meat. I'll start them on the indirect side. So if you were cooking over charcoal, push all your charcoal to one side, start them over the indirect side, bring them up to about 150 degrees with a digital thermometer, and then move them over to the hot side, skin side down. That'll crisp the skin. Take it up to 160. You're going to be perfectly safe. Really rich, intense flavors.
Thanks a lot for that call, Curtis. Just a brief bit of time left, Meathead. What is going to be on your grill this Memorial Day weekend?
I just got a pizza oven shipped to me from Italy. And I'm a pizza freak. I am married an Italian American, and I love grilling pizzas, and I do it on my Weber kettle. I do it on my gas grills. And this is a genuine wood burning stone pizza oven, and I can't wait to fire it up.
All right, Meathead, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much. And happy grilling, everybody.
That was Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com. He joined us to talk about his new cookbook, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling.
And don't forget, we have that recipe for the chocolate chili barbecue sauce. You can find that over on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can keep on letting us know what you're going to be grilling this Memorial Day weekend, too.
And do you feel inspired by all the grilling tips from Meathead? A lot of ones. We got to have them back.
You're speechless. You're gesturing at the book.
I am.
Speechless.
I'm pointing at the book. I've learned so much that two heat approach. I've got to get a thermometer. I just overcook meat to be on the safe side. This could change my. And we didn't even get to it. A lot of
veggies.
We didn't
get to smoking too, which I'm motivated to get a smoker after looking at this book.
Yeah, and check this out. Also, grilled eggplant turned into baba ganoush. So yeah, we'll maybe have them back to give us some more grilling tips.
So it's been kind of hard to get work done in the Central Time offices the last couple of days, and not just because it's the Friday before Memorial Day weekend, but there's been a lot of activity outside our windows in the form of crows and hawks.
Yeah, it's been maybe a battleground out there. We've seen at least two hawks just swooping around. You thought red-tail hawks, right?
I'm pretty sure they're red-tails.
Yeah, and then a bunch of crows, a murder of crows, they say, and they really seem to not like each other very much.
We're really getting a lesson in ornithology, and also I think sort of urban wildlife
dynamics. Yeah.
Air-to-air combat. Who knew that they could sort of drop altitude so quickly, yeah. These crows and hawks?
Yeah, we're seeing a crow fly up and then dive bomb. Fly up and then dive them. I believe the hawks are there. And then we'll see the hawks flying around and back and forth. And sides have been taken inside the office. You're really with the hawks.
I'm kind of a hawk person. You're sort of more in favor of the crows. But being the daughter of a bird watcher, I don't know. Crows are they can get kind of nasty.
They
form these mobs and they attack owls during the day. And they mob hawks, too. They're kind of natural enemies.
Right. But hawks eat the crows sometimes.
Well, sometimes.
Is why they're mad. But on the other hand, if a bird species is going to develop enough intelligence to crowd out humankind and rule the surface of the earth, smart money's on the crows. I feel ambivalent.
All right, well, we'll keep you posted with the latest on the hawks and the
hawk
crows
versus crow and our new video game app. This is Central Time.